This is A New Angle, a show about cool people doing awesome things in and around Montana. I'm your host, Justin Angle. This show is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business. Hey folks, welcome back, and thanks for tuning in. Today, I am speaking with Priya Subrawal. Priya is an interdisciplinary ecologist and artist. They have an extensive background in multimedia storytelling and a passion for connecting with the natural world through art.
The least interesting rooms to be in are the rooms where there's only one voice or only one story. And that's all of our responsibility then, to show up with what we have.
I recently met Priya at a storytelling event at the Missoula Public Library, where they recited a powerful poem about wildfire. Since we share an interest in the topic, I invited Priya to come on the show to chat about our respective approaches to storytelling. Priya, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So tell us, where did you grow up and what did your parents do?
I grew up in Frisco, Colorado, a tiny little alpine town. My dad worked in the food industry and my mom was a teacher.
Okay. And you went to college at NYU. How did you make your way east for college?
I think growing up in a small town, I really had the, I got to get out and get to the big city type vibes.
That is certainly a move to the big city, one of the biggest. Yeah, talk about your experience there.
I loved it. I definitely feel like as a young queer kid and artist, like the New York scene gave me a space to kind of come into myself that I didn't quite find in my small town. It was also a super interesting place to start to study environmental studies, which was what I went to college for, and to start to pay attention to ecologies in such an urban space. That was really cool.
Did you know you wanted to focus on environmental studies pre-NYU, or was that an interest that emerged on campus?
And I felt very compelled by social justice movements, so I was thinking about political science and things like that. And coming from such an environmental place, you know, the economy of my hometown very much hinged on snow and outdoor recreation and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it was just the only thing that made sense to me, and it was the biggest thing on my mind, for sure.
Are there particular issues in the environmental space that are especially compelling to you?
Environmental justice is certainly at the core of my practice these days. As we're starting to experience the effects of climate change, it's the most vulnerable communities, lower-income communities, people of color, unhoused folks are experiencing the brunt of that, and also hold like the most compelling and interesting solutions.
Draw that out a little bit. How did you first become aware? I mean, it's so easy at first, as you're sort of starting to understand climate change, to focus on the climate itself and, you know, glaciers melting and those sorts of things. But once we start thinking about how those changes are affecting people and how those changes are unevenly distributed, how did that kind of become on your radar screen?
With enough attention, it sort of becomes clear the cause and effect of it all. And like you said, the unequal distribution of it. So my dad grew up in India and immigrated here.
Yeah.
And so kind of growing up in the West with all of these really strong ideals of like consumerism and capitalism and industrialization and all of that. Meanwhile, we would go back to India and visit, and there would just be all of this trash flooding the rivers and things like that. And the air was just full of smog. So I think very early you can kind of start to see the effect of some like belief systems and value systems and the distribution of power between the global North and the global South and the distribution of effect. And moving to New York as well and watching how coastal communities and often the communities that were most impacted by things like seawater rise are the lower income neighborhoods in New York, the projects and stuff. So almost everywhere you look, you can see the most vulnerable communities being impacted by climate consequences that they didn't cause and aren't responsible for.
And so telling stories about these communities and these people and these effects that they're experiencing, that's become a passion for you.
I feel like storytelling and communication is one of the most valuable things that I've found in responding to the climate crisis and adapting to it. And I feel like often we get kind of overwhelmed and frightened with the realities that we're in. And yeah, despair doesn't get us very far. Mm-hmm. I saw something on the internet earlier today that I wish I could remember who said it. It's a quote, but despair has never once benefited the oppressed, only the oppressor. So yeah, trying to focus on storytelling and communication in ways that are both hopeful and honest, which is a tough Venn diagram.
Yeah. And so you finish up at NYU and you come here to the University of Montana to pursue a master's degree in environmental studies. Talk about that choice. How did UM's program land on your radar?
It was actually kind of funny. Mark Sundin, who's my advisor and a writer here in the Environmental Studies Department, he called me up one day at NYU and was like, hey, I read your application. Would you like to move to Montana and become a writer? You know, we'll give you a TA-ship job and, yeah, come visit the program, check it out, see if you like it. And without knowing much more than that, I kind of said yes.
How's landing in Missoula?
I really like it.
Yeah.
It's a lot like where I grew up. I love the mountains. I always feel like without like mountains in my landscape, it's like my lid's blown off. And I have no idea where I am.
So we met a few weeks ago at a storytelling event at the Missoula Public Library with a focus on resilience. And we both sort of talked about wildfire from quite different perspectives with different sort of choices about approaching the story. Mm-hmm. With that setup, just talk about how you were invited to join that event and why wildfire is interesting to you.
So Robin Saha, the director of the department, approached me and asked if I had a poem or a short story for the event or if I wanted to write one. And he said that the focus was community climate resilience. And he mentioned that fire would be a part of the story as well as plants and drought and things like that. And fire and resilience was interestingly like on my list of things that I wanted to write about for a long time.
Okay.
And kind of like the circular nature of it. I think because the world has gotten increasingly apocalyptic. And I think through all of that, seeing fire is kind of a regenerative process. And reorienting my relationship with fire as I start to learn more about our history with it, especially in this landscape, through the context of settler colonialism and the much longer story of fire here.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those themes before we, and I'm hoping I can convince you to share your poem during this session. But yeah, how do you, you said your view of wildfire has changed over time. Maybe talk about that journey a little bit.
I think, like a lot of folks who grew up in the American West, I grew up quite afraid of fire.
Sure.
We'd have, like, here's what you do if your house burns down trainings at school. And I remember I would, like, sleep with my teddy bears in a way that I could, like, stand up and run if, like, my house started burning down. It was, a deep fear in my body for a very long time.
There's some good reason for
that. Oh, absolutely.
Like, it can be a scary thing.
Yeah.
And you lived in a zone that was vulnerable to wildfire on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. And I've had friends and family lose their houses and like have to completely restart. And
yes.
I fully understand the destructive capacity of fire. It's a deeply terrifying thing. And then as I got to undergrad and throughout grad school, I also started to realize that our impulse to suppress all fires is a very recent phenomenon, but it's something that sort of emerged in like the past century or so. Throughout like the National Park Service, National Forest Service, and actually for millennia, indigenous folks, but have been managing prescribed burns for a long time. And we see this also in Australia and in other ecosystems around the world, that historically fires have been allowed to burn moderately and on occasion every like few decades or so to kind of clear out the underbrush and clear out all of this kindling that accumulates. And that's kind of an essential part of the ecosystem that humans have been a part of and sort of facilitated for generations. And when we started suppressing fires about 100 or so years ago, that kind of threw it out of whack.
Yes.
So we would get these really massive fires all of a sudden. Of course, climate change has also really contributed to that. There's no linear cause and effects here. But the more you suppress fires, the more they come around and burn brighter and more intensely later. So these massive fires that I was growing up with that were so terrifying were actually a result of decades of suppression and not letting things burn when they should.
And in your poem and in your approach here, you've talked about, you mentioned settler colonialism a moment ago. Like, not only have we made a decision, I say we, you know, the United States writ large has decided to put out fires, to suppress fire. You know, and that position, in fairness, has softened in recent decades. And I think we're sort of learning that it's really hard to roll back a policy of suppression once we have a society that's sort of adapted to that. Set that aside for a moment. The policy of suppression is also a policy of suppressing culture, as you mentioned. Not only were fires allowed to burn regularly, they were also embraced and intentionally set by a lot of indigenous cultures. Talk about your sort of understanding and exploration of those ideas.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing that you've hit on, that it's not just the suppression of a practice, but the suppression of a community and a value system and a belief system that goes with that. And I'm not indigenous, and so I can't speak for this community, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it does make me think about the larger value systems that might, I don't know, kind of inform our suppression and the fear that kind of goes with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of the fear of things burning and the fear of things going away and the hope that things might last forever, to me, underpins a lot of, I don't know, what I've seen in U.S. fire suppression policy and also a lot of practices that have led to maybe some of the other ecological crises that we encounter.
We'll be back to my conversation with Priya Subrawal after this short break. A New Angle is supported by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and UM's College of Business. Access to capital, broadband, and education are three ingredients any community needs for success.
Hi, this is Anya Jabor, Regents Professor of History at the University of Montana, and you are listening to A New Angle.
Welcome back to A New Angle. I'm speaking with Priya Subrawal about their unique approach to storytelling. I would love for you to share the poem that you not only created, but also shared at the storytelling event. Are you willing to do that?
Yeah, for sure. This is called Untitled Poem About Fire. I have a confession to make. I love the smell of wildfire. It makes me homesick. I grew up in the Mountain West, and every summer is smokier than the one before. Brittle lodgepole pines going up in an orange flash, the ashy haze scratching the throat and tearing up the eyes, an assault on all the senses. The thing is, it also smells like breakfast in India, like my grandmother's old house. Chai simmering gently over wood-burning stoves, rotis licked by the flame. It looks like India, too. Sunlight filtering through the smoke in the softest, warmest orange, the polluted haze of our shared smog, a pinkish glow I now know mostly through memory and rose-colored nostalgia, a sunrise that lasts the whole day. Even now, as climate chaos crispens the landscape that I call home, I can't help but soften at the smell of things coming undone. Forgive me for loving a burning world. You see, I have no other world, and I have no other love. The thing is, I believe in life after death, not because I'm a little bit Buddhist or a little bit Hindu, but because I'm a little bit of an ecologist, so I can tell you that the seeds of a lodgepole pine are fire-activated, meaning their cones are closed tightly with this resin that melts when exposed to the flame, meaning that they must burn in order to become, meaning encoded in their bodies is the anticipation of destruction, the understanding that something must end for new life to grow, that if fires are allowed to burn, they will clear the understory so that young saplings have room to root, churn nutrients back into the soil, make space for life to cycle over itself. The thing is, life doesn't always move in cycles. Sometimes it moves in spirals. The thing is, we can't talk about fire in the American West without talking about fear. About how, for the last century or so, suppression was the settler law of the land. Smokey Bear and his promise that only you can prevent forest fire. You see, that's how I knew he wasn't a real bear. If he was, he'd have been paying attention, would have noticed native folks tending wildfires like a careful hearth for generations, would have watched the pine cones melt and crack open into fresh green every few decades, the entire ecosystem unfolding and stitching itself back together again, and the humans a crucial part of it all. And maybe he would have said something else, like, why the hell are you trying to prevent forest fires in the first place? And what are you so afraid of? And what, you thought you were going to live forever? All that suppression, the refusal to let things burn, it adds up. It lets kindling accumulate for generations, layer the forest floor in matchsticks, ready to boom in an instant blaze at the smallest spark, burn brighter, hotter, hungrier. Things always come back around, and nothing, and no one, can be suppressed forever. Did you know the U.S. military-industrial complex is the largest institutional contributor to climate change? The U.S. imperial war machine will burn, and Palestine will be free. The U.S. imperial war machine will burn, and the Wilani Forest in Atlanta will be free. The empires will burn, and we will be free. The empires will burn, and we will be free. The empires will burn, and we will be free. There is an inevitability to fire. There is an inevitability to the seeds that emerge from the ashes. There's responsibility there, too. What I'm saying is there must be a difference between the fire under the simmering stove of the slowly burnt chai in Delhi, and the fire that burned for a week in the valley last May, and the fires that indigenous people light in the tall grasses of their homes, that burn gently like the edge of a piece of paper, and the fire that I use to light a cigarette on the rare, impulsive, indulgent occasion, spark in hand, and the fire that is burning somewhere else right now. But I think what they all have in common might be a sense of responsibility, both for destruction and for what comes after. Fire demands attention, and left untended becomes dangerous. Attention is not control. It is humility and curious attempts at understanding. Mary Oliver says attention is the beginning of devotion, and I think she's right. And I think attention is part of the difference between fire starters and fire tenders. I think to tend fire, we must be tender-er. What I am saying is all I have are these two hands, and you have yours. And the fact of the matter is that we are capable of burning things, for better or for worse, and often for both. And we are left with what has been burned. And I like the smell of wildfires, of things coming undone. It smells like breakfast and looks like a sunrise that lasts all day.
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I ask you what you feel when you, both when you create something like that, but also when you recite it?
It makes me feel, I don't know, I feel like writing at this point is a thing that my body does to process feelings that are a little bit on the edge of being known or named. And then to recite it and to have someone hear it, to put it out into the world, I think is the second half of that, kind of trying to collectively get to an emotion that's a bit tough to land on.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel conflicting emotions when I think about fire, and so it's helpful to kind of chew on those emotions.
Yeah, not being a creative writer, I'm just fascinated by your process and experience of that process. So for me, like, I do a lot of academic writing. When I'm writing, I'm thinking about like sentence structure and how persuasive this is, and do I have the right arguments, and are they structured in the right way and supported in the right way? What's the process of creating something like a poem? How do you even go about it?
Yeah, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like I just put my brain into a blender and then something comes out.
Okay.
I suppose the answer is just like a lot of cups of tea. I often feel that before I start writing a poem, I start with like the emotions that I have. And I guess the intention here was literally to write a poem about fire for the message of community resilience. And so I'm grateful that I had an assignment to write to.
Yeah.
I think that is always helpful. And I've always felt quite conflicted about how I love the smell of wildfire, how it brings up this eerie nostalgia for me.
Your work sounds both, you know, there's a heaviness to it. Like it feels like it's meeting the seriousness of the topic. Yet there's also a hopefulness and a whimsy to it. Talk about those emotions, and I can see that sort of play. I could see it in your body as you were reciting the poem. What I guess what I'm asking is, in the midst of this heaviness, how do you maintain a playful relationship with the topic?
I mean, I do feel like we have kind of an obligation to hope and a responsibility to it. Yeah, and I think sitting with complexity and letting things be both full of despair and hopeful is also something that's really important. I think we as humans love to categorize things, you know, either doom or hope.
Sure.
You know,
binary.
Yeah, we'll either make it out or we won't. And the fact of the matter is that we'll make it out a little bit and some of us won't, and nothing is ever very clear. And yeah, sitting with multiple truths at once, that like it has never been this bad and it will continue to get worse. And, you know, there will continue to be seedlings and children and tadpoles. And I have a responsibility to them to love this world and put my best into it, even if I don't always believe it. And I think that is one of the most important things about hope. You know, it doesn't have to be true in order to be useful.
Are there specific things that make you hopeful? Are there examples where you look to a group of people or an organization or a place that, like, hey, they seem to be onto something here?
Yeah, two things come to mind for that. I guess for one, I'll say that I'm always and forever will be inspired by movements towards collective liberation of the past. Particularly like Black liberation movements, queer and trans liberation movements, the people who came before us who didn't get to see how it was all turning out, knowing, of course, that it hasn't turned out and will always be turning. I just see this incredible lineage of people fighting for futures that they could not quite see and having hope in spite of the most bleak circumstances. And if they could do it, we could do something like it at least. And also from like the ecology around me all the time. Right now it is winter, so maybe I shouldn't be feeling this hope, but I'm watching the buds sprout. And I was out walking around Blue Mountain yesterday and I saw this like fresh green grass and moss. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like sitting with the cognitive dissonance of this is winter and it's eerie that it is so warm and it's climate change and El Nino and all of that. And my little seasonal depression body is like lusting for the sunlight and just like, I don't know, my heart is opening up watching this early spring happen. And I'll take hope even if it's in weird places, you know, even if it's climate change induced, because everything is at this point.
I mean, where do you see your work going at this point? Like, what are you working on broadly in your master's program? And then where do you see that program and your accumulation of experiences and expressions so far pointing to?
Ideally, I'd love to keep working in media and communication and keep writing and also keep working with the land and farming. yeah, keeping a balance of those things. I think those of us who work in storytelling often spend our days touching a computer.
And we focused on your poetry and writing, but you're also a videographer. You do digital multimedia. Talk about your approach to using a wide variety of media in your storytelling.
I've always found really compelling stories coming from a wide variety of places, like documentary films and poetry and graphic art and all of that. And I think I realized that there are just so many ways that story can impact people. And a lot of people aren't readers, you know? A lot of people learn visually. A lot of people learn with a soundtrack. And that's really cool. And it's really exciting to use all of the tools at our disposal. Yeah, I think it also like really allows for creative work to not be honed in by a certain medium.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, I'm sort of glancing over at this black piece of glass and wires on the counter, and I think, okay, that is such the prominent canvas of storytellers these days. Yet within that, there are so many problems. Like, set aside all the problems with how those things are made and how the making of them affects those ecosystems and those people, but how those devices are so addictive and so extractive. How do you think about such things? How do you reconcile these sort of attention economy in which artists are trying to find their way these days?
Oh, yeah. I think about it all the time. We'd all be better off if we just like threw our phones in the river and went outside.
Yeah.
And at the same time, that's not the world that we live in. And I really appreciate it for like the democratization of knowledge that it provides and the connection. And I do believe that these digital spaces are real spaces. They are places. You know, they're not cloud. They're upheld by like, yeah, cables and underwater wires and lithium mined and all of these places. And I think it's important to remember that even though it feels like a commons, it's a marketplace, not a commons. And it's controlled by power systems and power structures. Right now, one of my jobs is I work as a graphic artist for a company on Instagram. And it's wild the amount of words that we can't say because of meta policies, the amount of backbending that we have to do around the algorithm. And so even though it feels like such a freely accessible space, and I do feel like many times it's the closest thing to a commons that we sometimes have in media, which is, I think, probably a problem. We have to acknowledge that it is not a neutral space, and there are restrictions that come with that.
And not only is it not a neutral space, it's a space that presents as neutral under the guise of monetization.
Oh, yeah.
Like, ultimately, the goal is monetization, and the way to do that is to steer us to various mood states, most often enragement, in order to continue to monetize us.
Yeah.
And then as an artist or as a storyteller or as a news gatherer or whatever your outlet is, you know, to sort of optimize the outcome of what you're creating, it's hard to ignore those incentives that are built into this. You know, the algorithm is opaque, but we know enough about what it does to know how to gain traction.
Yeah, it's really tricky with like the intention economy and like, yeah, trying to maneuver within it on both sides. I think a lot about the film The Social Network, that documentary. They have this phrase where it's like the only industries that call its customers users are drugs and the social internet. And that's because you're the commodity. And that's so eerie that you're just like vying for attention, and certain things will get it and certain things that aren't maybe necessarily useful to our public consciousness. And I don't fully have an answer for how do we exist in a world where Instagram is so essential, but I do feel like I always want to try to make it worth it, whatever that means, like worth the carbon it takes to post something or worth the glass that was blown to look at it or all of that. Yeah, to kind of like nudge that arc of the universe towards justice, I suppose, the collective story, I guess.
I mean, you seem to have a real pragmatism built into your strong idealism. You know, I get a sense pretty clearly, not only from meeting you at the library event, but in this conversation, what you're about and your value system. But also there's a pragmatism in that is also, it's beautiful in a way, because I feel like you are prepared to move through this world, not only with integrity, but efficacy as well.
I appreciate that. I hope to. I don't know if I will. It's a confusing and weird world.
So, Priya, as we close here, two things. First, if there are listeners out there who are, you know, writing or creating or making video, how would you encourage them? Any words of wisdom or advice or things to keep them pressing forward.
Yeah, I mean, just like keep making stuff, make weird stuff, make bad stuff, make stuff you don't show anyone, make stuff and then feel confident enough to show it to people, even if you think it's weird. But then I think about like how many stories have impacted me and saved me, and how sucky it would be if the people who wrote them weren't there. There's this poet who I love, their name is Andrea Gibson, and when I was a kid in like speech and debate and doing like little poetry competitions or whatever, I would always hear their poems being read. And they were like the first poet that I ever loved. They were also the first non-binary person I ever encountered.
Okay.
And I'm thinking about them now, and I'm telling this story now, because a few weeks ago, Nex Benedict, a non-binary student, a high school student in Oklahoma, was killed by their classmates, in the high school bathroom, and no one called for an ambulance or anything like that. And I'm just thinking a lot about how much queer kids deserve to grow up and become queer adults, and how few stories I had when I was growing up for people like me. And how few stories there are in general, and how that kind of leads to, I don't know, a lot of hate and a lot of misunderstanding and fear and confusion. And the least interesting rooms to be in are the rooms where there's only one voice or only one story. And that's all of our responsibility then, to show up with what we have.
Priya, if folks want to learn more about your work, where would you point them online?
You can find my portfolio on my website, priyasubberwal.com. You can also find me on Instagram, screaming into the void of the internet, at priya_roo, R-O-O.
Super. Well, Priya, thanks for coming in here. Thanks for the work you do. And I wish you all the best and hope we can visit again down the road.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been great.
Thanks for listening to A New Angle. We really appreciate it. And we're coming to you from Studio 49. Generous gift from UM alums Michelle and Warren Hansen. A New Angle is presented by First Security Bank, Blackfoot Communications, and the University of Montana College of Business, with additional support from Consolidated Electrical Distributors, Drum Coffee, and Montana Public Radio. Kelly Larson is our producer. Maddie Jordan is our production assistant. VTO, Jeff Ament, and John Wicks made our music. And Jeff Meese is our master of all things sound. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.